Everybody. We will be only do a little bit more introduction on me and then an overview of what we'll be talking about this week. Feel free to drop in for one or more of these sessions. They do build on each other, but they should all stand alone also. I'm hoping that we will be in conversation as much as I will be talking. I am an undergraduate teacher, so I'm used to 19-year-olds who sit there and try and hide under their baseball caps. So if I start rambling and filling space, feel free to jump in, put your hand up, just start talking, interrupt me, that's great. My name is Jacob Rinderknecht. I currently live in San Antonio, Texas. I just bought a house there, so I guess that makes me a Texan, which makes me a little bit uncomfortable. I'm a Midwesterner, grew up in Ohio, went to Valpo, which is how I originally came in contact with Holden. John Stephen Paul of Blessed Memory brought a group called Soul Purpose from Holden to be artists in residence in the summer of 2000, which was the first time I got up here, and decided that I needed to spend some more time, so I spent a year here as the village potter after absolutely just crashing after way too much going on during my undergraduate, so came up to a place with at that time, not even email, and spent a year going back and forth between the village pottery and the kitchen, which was sort of perfect for me as an ambivert, because I got a week totally by myself, and then a week in a herd, and then a week totally by myself. And so then I got back to Holden Next in 2008. At that point, I was a Benedictine monk in Collegeville, Minnesota at St. John's. Some of you may know St. John's and St. Ben's. Brought a group of students up, and it was a really critical time for me because I was discerning about whether or not I was going to stay a monk for the rest of my life or not. I was at the point I had to decide, and decided to leave, and got my doctorate. I'm a systematic theologian. I work on got into thinking about how it is that different kinds of Christians talk to each other. So I wrote my dissertation on the Joint Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification. Anyone heard of the JDDJ? It is the 20th anniversary this year of the Joint Declaration, which is in some ways the high watermark of contemporary ecumenism, in which the Catholics and the Lutherans said, hey, all those things we said in the 16th century about justification and about how people were heretics, they were true, but they don't apply to you. Which, think about what that's saying. It's not saying the Council of Trent was wrong, right? It's not saying that the Augsburg Confession is wrong. What it's saying is, Lutherans and Catholics, even when it seemed like they were disagreeing, were talking about different things. Now, let me give you one example about why that's a little bit complicated and confusing. Lutherans said, concupiscence is sin. Anyone remember what concupiscence is from catechism classes at some point, maybe?
No.
Concupiscence is the post-baptismal, all the stuff that makes sin more likely. So think about it this way. Okay. We baptize infants, right? When we talk about baptizing infants, and someone once asked the question, why do we baptize infants around the time of St. Augustine? Anyone know how we answered that question? Why do we baptize infants?
To make sure they don't go to hell before they die.
Well, why would infants go to hell? They haven't sinned.
They were born.
Okay, they were born. Why would that send them to hell?
That's the story.
Everyone's born with original sin.
Original sin. Original sin is an answer to a question. Turns out, all theological doctrines and dogmas are answers to questions. And if you don't understand the question, you won't understand the answer, right? So original sin is the answer to the question, in some sense, why do we baptize infants? It's also the answer to the question, why is the world so screwed up? Right? We'll get back to original sin probably Wednesday. But Lutheran said, concupiscence, the stuff that's left out, because if baptism fixes original sin, why isn't the world perfect? Why isn't the church perfect? I'm a Catholic. The church is not perfect, I can tell you. I'm guessing the Lutheran church not so perfect either. Right? Why is that true? If baptism fixes sin, what's going on? And so Augustine and friends talk about concupiscence, which just comes from the Latin word concupiscentia, which means desire. And they use it to mean disordered desires. I always tell my students, You experience concupiscence when you wake up in the morning and you know you should go to the gym, but it's cold outside, and it's dark, and you have conflicting desires. You want to go to the gym, right? And you want to stay in bed, and at some point you have to decide between those things, because you can't do both of them, right? So concupiscence then, Lutherans said, is sin. Catholics said, concupiscence is not sin. Now that sounds like a pretty flat out contradiction, right? X is Y, X is not Y. How in the world do we get to 1999 and have Catholics and Lutherans say those things are compatible with each other, which is what the Joint Declaration does? That's what I wanted to understand. And so I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what was going on in the Joint Declaration on a number of questions like this. Concupiscence is just, in some sense, the easiest to explain. And in doing that, I got into studying cognitive linguistics, which we'll get to in the second half. Today we're going to do 40 minutes, take a quick break, because none of us has that long of an attention span, even at Holden Village. And then we're going to come back to conceptual mapping. And in studying cognitive linguistics, it opened up a lot of things for me. Now, none of this, one of the things I love about cognitive linguistics that helps me believe that it's true is that it comes to a lot of conclusions that theologians and philosophers had already come to in just reflecting on their experience, and gives us reasons for believing why that could, how that could happen. Let me give you an example. Anyone heard of George Limbeck? George Limbeck taught at Yale for years, a really important Lutheran theologian. He was one of the Lutheran observers to the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s. In the early 1980s, I bet there's a copy in the library, he wrote a book called, what's it called? Something of Doctrine. It will come to me. And his question is, what is doctrine? What is doctrine? And he ends up saying there's two major theories that most people operate with. Either doctrines are propositions, right? What's a proposition? Yeah,
theory.
An abstract theory, a rule, right? Two plus two equals four is a proposition, right? It is universally true. No matter what two things you have, if you add two more, you have four of them, right? And then he said there's this other group of people who think of doctrine as sort of expressions of universal feelings. For the theologians in the room, these are the sort of descendants of Schleiermacher, right? So you have, and if you think about it, think about American Lutheranism in your heads, right? You can think about, because Limbeck was a Lutheran, think about two major trends that you might have experienced in Lutheranism. On the one hand, you have people saying, doctrines are rules, they're universally true, it doesn't matter who you are, this is what we believe. You may know some Lutherans like that, right? On the other hand, you have people saying, doctrines are expressions of universal things that we all experience. You may know some Lutherans like that. Maybe, perhaps, here, right? Lindbeck says, both of these are 19th century modernism gone wrong. And instead, we need to think about doctrines as rules. Doctrines are like grammatical rules by which the nature of doctrine, that's the name of the book. So George Lindbeck's The Nature of Doctrine is what this piece is from. So he says, we think of doctrines are rules. Doctrines lead us to the ability to say true things, much like grammatical rules. In order to say a true thing, I have to say it truthfully within a system. So Limbeck is famous for saying, if you say Jesus is Lord while killing somebody, you have falsified the truth of your statement, because you are no longer speaking about Jesus. Anyway, so this is the argument of this book. And I loved George Limbeck when I was in master's school, and I got to doctoral school, and I was trying to figure out how this all worked, and I ran into cognitive linguistics, and suddenly there's explanations for why Limbeck might be right, and for helping to sort of understand why people are so worried about Limbeck, right? So you can imagine the propositionalists in the room saying, well, but Jesus is Lord whether or not I'm using that as a reason for killing somebody, right? And on the other hand, you can imagine the other folks saying, Well, you know, Jesus is an expression of a universal truth about how God is our Father and all people are siblings. And so, yes, I can see that, but that's not really true in the propositional sense anyway, right? Lindbeck is trying to hold on to why we can say that the creed is true, right? And not just meaningful. While also saying faith is not math, right? So what we're going to be talking about this week is going back into this whole area of cognitive linguistics, which comes out of, it comes out of two things coming together. None of them theological. Most of the cognitive linguists are terrible theologians. One of my favorites is a guy named, who gave these lectures? The Gifford Lectures by George Lakoff gave these lectures. And George Lakoff, in his Gifford Lectures, goes on and on about religion, and he has no idea what he's talking about. Just none. So the things that he's rejecting in those lectures as religion are, in fact, the things that classical monotheism is also rejecting. Like, the soul is a ghost in the machine, right? We do not say you are a body, which you are a soul which has a body. That is, in fact, heretical in the Christian tradition, right? You are an embodied soul. Those two things aren't divisible. We'll get back to that on Wednesday, too. But what they do is these ways they talk about language and meaning and culture and thinking give us ways to talk about all of the ways that we think, and one of the ways that we think is religiously. So these are tools, then, that I could use to explain why concupiscence is sin and concupiscence is not sin. We're not, in fact, in contradiction with each other. By the way, short version, turns out they weren't disagreeing about concupiscence, they were disagreeing about sin. The Catholics were concerned that if you said concupiscence was sin, that what you were doing was making baptism ineffective. If people are still sinful after baptism, baptism doesn't do anything. And they were saying, if sin is the division from God, and baptism is ineffective, then God is a liar, so that can't be true. Lutherans were saying, specifically Philip Melanchthon in the Augsburg Confession, and also Luther at a bunch of places, were saying that the ways that we live now in this concupiscent turmoil are not God's final desire for us. We are not yet what we will be. And therefore, they're part of the sinful part of the world that will be burned off in the remaking of it. So Lutherans and Catholics, turns out, not disagreeing on concupiscence. Because everybody looking around at their world says, hey, God has promised to save us. That is a real promise which has real effects in our lives. And also, we're not that yet that thing. We are and are not yet that thing, right? Christianity is an eschatological religion. We live in the already not yet. You heard that stuff before? This is not new. By the way, I have to tell you all, thank you so much. My favorite example that always gets students to understand eschatology is Son Over Buckskin Day.
Oh.
Does anyone know what Son Over Buckskin Day is? We have a lot of long-term folks in the room.
Yeah.
Let's explain it for the rest of you. Buckskin Mountain, right? The sun in the winter rises in the saddle and sets in the saddle. So in December, you get what? Hour and a quarter of direct sunlight?
Yeah, a good day.
Which you can imagine what that's like, right? So the first day that the sun actually comes up over Buckskin Mountain, suddenly you get 8.5-ish hours of direct light. You can imagine what that does to people's moods, right? So, that's in March usually?
February.
Okay. So what's the village like in February?
Snowy.
What? Hopeful, but what else?
Snowy.
It's snowy. How much snow is in the village in February in a typical year? A whole bunch.
Yeah, 6 feet on the ground.
Yeah?
Still snowing.
So at least the year that I lived here, on Son Over Buckskin Day, there was a cookout outdoors. And pretty much everyone showed up in their Hawaiian shirts and shorts, a couple of bikinis, to grill out in the snow because it was now clear that summer was coming. Mm. That's the Christian life.
That's beautiful.
Right? That's what an eschatological understanding is. And so, but how do you make sense of that? You have to hold on to both the winter and the summer. And Lutherans and Catholics were using their language differently to do that thing. But we'll get back to that on Wednesday. Let me stop right there real quick. Any questions about what we've talked about so far? Yeah.
I always
come in late. And what's that word?
Concupiscence? You want me to write it out for you?
Yeah. And was there a meeting Catholic or Lutheran?
Concupiscence means in Latin, concupiscentia means desire. In theology, we use the word concupiscence to mean the disordered desires, or another way of talking about it is the lack of original justice. So, I wasn't at this morning's talk because I was frantically finishing my notes, but he's been re-narrating stories for meaning for us, right? So if we talk about how we tell the Adam and Eve story, one of the things that we tend to say about Adam and Eve in the classical tradition is that they didn't have original sin. They had original justice. And original justice, so we tell the story, was the faculty to always know what the right decision was, to weigh all of the competing desires and be pulled towards the right decision. So if we think about Augustine up through Thomas Aquinas and how they talk about the effects of the fall, it's three. It's original sin, the lack of original justice, and concupiscence, which is the sort of positive form of the lack of original justice, right? Does that make more sense?
Yeah.
So when you wake up in the morning and you can't, and you know you should want to go work out.
Exactly what happened.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But it's warm in your bed and possibly still dark. You are experiencing the lack of original justice, being pulled in two directions, because both being warm and working out are good things for you. And sort of properly getting all the stuff in line is, in some sense, it's one way of telling the work of Christian living, right? This is a sidetrack. I love sidetracks, I'm sorry. But the desert monks, who are some of my favorite Christians ever, built their entire life around the beatitude, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." Now, that seems odd to us, because when we think about purity of heart, we tend to think about moral rectitude, right? The monks and the nuns did not think about purity of heart that way. The heart for them was the organ of desire. And to have a pure heart meant to have a heart that desired one thing. Or Ron Rollheiser, is that a name that folks in the room have heard of? If not, his book, The Holy Longing, is really worth your time. Ron is the now former president of the Oblate School of Theology in San Antonio. He wrote a book called The Holy Longing. It's a book on spirituality that I teach pretty often. And he talks about this as willing the one thing, not being in bed. The perfectly integrated person doesn't have trouble getting out of bed and going to work out. But it's because all of their desires have been integrated into the one thing that we desire, which is, anyone want to guess? What? What's the one thing we desire? Come on, this is the way the Sunday school answers, right? God. The one thing we desire is God, right? All of our desires are ordered towards the one desire of God, right? For the desert monks and nuns. So they go out to the desert in order to learn to desire one thing. Because they read the Beatitude, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God," to mean that God will give those who desire the one thing exactly what they desire. That is the fulfillment of human living. By the way, this is just straight up Plato also. But, you know, Platonism was the currency of the day. Does that make sense of what concupiscence is? Concupiscence is where that system breaks down. Okay, but we may talk a little bit more about that on Wednesday. I haven't decided yet. But you at least see how I got into this question. Other big word I make sure all of my undergraduates know is this one. Metacognition. Anyone want to take a stab at what metacognition is?
Thinking about thinking.
Yeah, exactly. And that is what we're going to be doing today. So in order to get us into that, because I have been talking for way too long, I'd like us to take 3 minutes. And we're going to do something, if you practice Vipassana or another form of mindfulness meditation, it's going to be a little bit like that, except instead of paying attention to your breath, I would like you to pay attention to your thinking. Try to just pay attention to what's going on. See how you see yourself think. Now I'm going to warn you, the way that we see ourselves thinking is not in fact how we think, but it's a good place to start. So I'm going to set a timer for 3 minutes, and we'll get a we will get some chimes when we're done. So close your eyes, pay attention. If it helps by starting to listen to your breath, that's fine. And see what's going on when you think. See if you can observe yourself thinking. Okay, as you set aside, we're going to do a little bit of a think, pair, share exercise, although you've done. So take, I want to take a little bit of time and think about what just happened. What did you observe? And then in 30 seconds or so, I'll ask you to share that with somebody next to you, maybe somebody you haven't talked to recently. Introduce yourselves first, that's important. And then we'll have a little bit of a conversation about that. But we'll give the introverts 30 seconds to think about it first. Okay, when you're ready, find somebody to talk to.
Everywhere, and the kids winding up. Yes, I had a similar experience in getting shaming about that.
And I think this is my
heart. And then about 2 minutes before she started talking,
feel free to join a group or think on your own. I'm Jacob. Nice to meet you.
Why am I?
Would you have practiced?
No, all I know about is.
Okay, we invite you to focus your conversation on this question.
And I started thinking about the watcher.
When we think, what are we doing? So out of, when we think, what are we doing? So you can come up with, in your same group there, out of the conversation you've been having, what is it we're doing when we think? Okay, who wants to be brave and get us started in the big group? We're not wrong is not. Okay, let's attend here.
My experience is that we hear things we experience. You know, I would hear the child cry, and so then I would like make up this all these reasons why the child would be crying. Then somebody came in the door, and then I would think about who that might be or why they were late. So all the things that also to, you know, it's almost like to validate the things that I hear and the things that I might experience in a day. So I just pad my story.
So thinking is storytelling.
Yeah.
Thinking is explanations, right?
Yeah.
There are two things I heard you say.
A story especially. Because I now have several stories from that 3 minutes.
Okay, good. Sorry, we all want to hear you.
This might be similar, but I think when I'm ruminating, my brain is like sorting my experiences into various file cabinets because my mind likes to have a cohesive narrative of my experience.
Okay, so categorization. We think often very much in terms of filing cabinets, right? We think so much in terms of this that when we invented our next great technology, the computer, we gave it a desktop with filing systems and a trash can, right?
Right.
Well,
I can say it loud. There's a certain kind of naming. I experience myself as something is happening, and then for me, it's visual, and I see something, and in some way, I'm naming it or giving it some reality.
Okay, so naming is both a kind of categorization and a kind of storytelling. Yeah?
So I think I'm a little in the storytelling, perhaps, or explanations, but I think the bottom line is interpret. It's my mind is helping interpret everything going on around me, and with sort of question of, am I safe, ultimately?
Okay, good.
I actually didn't do this time, but one thing that I know I do when I'm thinking sometimes is I will have conversations in my head that I either, like I'm redoing a conversation I had that wasn't that good, and that if, or if I'm, something is coming up, I'm going back and forth. So maybe that's rehearsing or replaying something.
Sure, yeah, we often spend a lot of time going back over, remembering, right? Mm. One thing I haven't heard anybody say so far, which is unusual, is computation. For the last 50 years, we've tended to think of the brain as a computer. Right? You ever heard that?
Yeah.
Is that a metaphor that we've engaged with before? The brain is a computer. And in fact, if you think about how we talk about personhood, thinking, brain in popular culture, what's the big question of the moment? When will AI overtake us?
Yes.
Right? When will artificial intelligence outthink us? So I mentioned that cognitive linguistics comes out of linguistics, but it also comes out of early engagements with artificial intelligence. Because it turns out that if you think about the brain as a computer, as we often do, or as a narrator, we lead ourselves down some places that don't turn out to sort of check out, right? So it's fairly easy to program a computer to play chess, right? Even when I was a kid in the 80s, you could play against a computer and lose in chess, right? It is really hard to program a computer to figure out how to leave a room it's never been in before, right? But find any 18-month-old human, and as soon as they're walking, what are they doing? They're escaping, right? Yeah, we have to childproof our houses because your kids know how to get out of a room that they've never been in before. They know how to pick up a spoon that they've never picked up before. You don't have to reprogram yourself for every coffee cup. Otherwise, getting through the village dining hall here would be impossible because there's no two coffee cups that are the same, right? But you don't think, oh, how do I pick up this coffee cup, right? It's not like any of the others I've seen since I've been here. We seem to think differently than do the things that we program. And part of that has to do with how we do abstraction. And we're gonna talk about that after we take a break. But let me give you the thesis of today before we do that. Our historic ways of thinking about thinking, which we often do in philosophy and often do in theology, leads to saying that the basic mode of thinking is literality. Remember when I was talking about George Lindbeck's categories, right? The propositionalists. Well, math is just more basic. It's just more universal. It's literal. And metaphor and analogy and all these things, they're kind of floral additions. You can deal without them. Your life would be impoverished, but you can deal without them. I know there are artists in the room, I'm sorry. But this is the story we have told ourselves for a long time, right? You have to, what is literally true is the basic question. When cognitive scientists started talking to linguists who'd been going around looking at how actual human languages function over time, and we'll talk a little bit more about that after the break, I'm going to quote here a chapter by Robert Masson in the last book that I edited, which I think sums this up really well. According to this research, reasoning and concepts are not literal, abstract, and disembodied. literal, abstract, and disembodied. Which happens in both our computer metaphor, right? Because how do computers think? Literally, abstractly, and, I mean, they have a thing, but we think about the code as a disembodied thing, right? And in our narrator mode, we tend to think about the narrator naming things, putting them in categories. Abstractly, this is a chair. I can recognize all chairs. And in a disembodied way, we think about the narrator inside our head as if it is separate from our body, right? We call this the subject-self distinction. So whichever of our two major metaphors we're using to think about how we think, whether it's the narrator or the computer, we tend to think about literal, abstract, and disembodied as the bases of thought. But instead, our conceptual systems and our inferences, they arise from, use, and are crucially shaped by the perceptual and motor systems of our bodies and the neural systems of our brains. Therefore, metaphorical mappings, metaphors, are not secondary and illustrative. Reasoning, instead, is guided by metaphorical mappings derived from our embodiment. These metaphorical mappings are fundamental. They are pervasive features of our human thought and language. Bob Masson will title his first book on this topic, Without Metaphor, No Saving God. And we can extend that, without metaphor, no human thought. So one of the things that conceptual linguists tell us is the ability to think metaphorically, which is to map something from one domain of thought onto another domain of thought, is absolutely basic to how humans think. Human language and cognition are impossible without it. And you can't escape it in anything you do. Let me give you an example. Someone was telling me yesterday that it was a fairly hot August, beginning of August here, before we get here. When we say the temperature went up, that is metaphorical. Because it is built on a very basic metaphor that we all learned as very small people, which is more is up. And also, temperature, movement is more. You can't stack. What is temperature? Temperature is the movement of molecules in the air, right? Temperature is actually speed. It's average speed of molecules. No one's confused when I say the temperature went up. Partly because we have ensconced that set of metaphors into a physical object we call a thermometer, in which the mercury goes up, or the alcohol goes up in a more contemporary thermometer, right? And that holds for us all of these ideas. And so we think about the temperature going up. And there's a whole set of these. It's time for a break, but we're gonna talk about these afterwards, these basic metaphors there. Affection is warmth, more is up, more is better, and it turns out that more is better is less basic than more is up, because if the two of them come into conflict, more is up wins. If I say inflation went up, nobody thinks I mean it got better, right? But these are the sort of most basic levels of our thinking. And so once we start thinking about how we think that way, that changes some of the things we can say. Okay, I promised you a break. It's 10 after. Yes.
So is the thinking that we are like antsy and can't sit through a full hour and a half? Because I'm interested in what you're saying, and the break is like always hard to get everybody back. Is there any way we could just work all the way through?
That's not up to me. I think being embodied, it's better if we take a little bit of a break for people. But I will ask, to quote the West Wing, that you keep our 5-minute break closer to 10 than 20 minutes. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you've been there before.
I've been here before. So it's 12 after. I will start again at 20 after. And that way we will have some time for what we're talking about. Okay? Thank you very much.
I heard you say about white person about the gate. I was actually here the whole time.
For a long time.
Right? It's the same problem as soul, right? You're not separable from any of the pieces.
Are you sure?
I am, in fact.
I like to tell you, how long would it take the spirit to take a 5-minute break?
Yeah.
Thanks for this. What about future? It sounds like remembering, would that be a form of like anxiety type of thing? It's usually based on the fear so, is based on the future.
Yeah, it's an analogical mode of thinking, actually.
And which one of those?
It's a new thing. I mean, there's a lot more.
This is not exhaustive.
No. There's a lot more.
I was thinking anything about the future. I didn't see it.
No, so in fact, future,
well, sure, I mean, it is.
It's a kind of storytelling.
You know,
it's a kind of analogical storytelling. So based on my history of what I know the world to be and how I experience things are now, this is the story I'm going to tell about what's going to happen, which is partly why politics gets so complicated, because we tell differing stories. Yeah.
I would have been fine going.
But I
usually don't do it. He's the first one I've got.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm ADHD, so like, you know, people.
Yeah.
Great. A lot to get up and down. Right.
Yeah, sure.
But I just, like, cool. I
feel like I've been.
I know I should stand up. I do think I should.
I'm not sure what that means, but I think
it sounds like a good thing.
My brain is thinking so hard that
I went to the
really Frank's
college
with a celebrity.
I went to his new museum.
Oh, you did?
Well,
thank you.
Last June.
Wow. But notice what your brain's doing. Your brain is making analogies to all the things you do.
Wow. We're taking the trip down to the States and relatives and friends and the whole stuff.
So that I can feel
Georgia and all that. Definitely
no, sure,
in our
but
way.
I just think one, it's the only way you can engage with it.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Have you read this book?
No, I mean, I'm familiar with a lot of the stories from here. I've heard him speak a lot. I've never read the book. I've gifted the book to other people, but I've never read it.
And there's a documentary out about him now.
Is that
Purpose?
Yep.
True Justice?
Okay.
I'm 42. Okay, well, I'm 60. Yeah, I was thinking 42, so he was still active enough for you to remember him then.
Yeah. So, you know, so Tony had talked about Brian's work, and then when I finally, you know, got to connect with Brian's work, it was like, oh, you're the guy who Tony kept talking about, this guy that was a high achiever.
Did you talk to him?
Brian? Yeah.
Brian Stevens?
Yeah, briefly. We did the National Youth Gathering 3 years ago together. Yeah.
How exciting.
Yeah, he's a really great guy.
He is wonderful. I have actually listened to a bunch of different interviews with him online. And there's all similar parts, but there's also different parts.
Yeah.
There's only one in which he tells the story of, you know, getting his polio shot as a little kid in the back of a hospital where they're, you know, drinking and what. And that was a great story. He doesn't tell it anywhere else. And then there's another great time where he's talking with Ezra Klein, they did that interview, and they're talking about the Confederate statues. And Ezra Klein was talking about he's Jewish when he went to Germany and hearing the German language and comparing the whole issue to, you know, Hitler. And there's no Hitler statues over there.
Right. Exactly.
And, you know, and so then I thought, oh, thinking it in those terms. Because I've always, you know, they say, well, it's our history.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it is history. But it's like having little Hitler statues all over.
Right.
Or the high school, like Jefferson Davis High School. It's like sending Jewish kids to the high school.
I know.
That made it really, I know. So that was a great interview. And I didn't hear that in any others either. But it was, you know, he's just
so many great stories and things.
Anyway. People talk about that a lot, like with the Holocaust, or when the Shoah, or 9/11, where they say, you know, never forget, and when it comes to, you know, whether it be indigenous genocide or, you know, black genocide, it's like, why, that was so long ago, why do you keep focusing on that, you know? What did I have to do with that?
Yeah, it's still happening.
Oh, yeah, my husband's going to be expensive. He's done a misdemeanor.
Hello.
Do you know Sister Helen at all?
I've read the book. I've been walking.
Yeah, we did together like a few years ago. The work she's doing, it exists.
Yeah.
I don't have this jacket.
Yeah, that was a long time ago that book came out, and the movie came out.
If we start moving around a little bit.
Have you seen that?
Yeah.
So that is interesting.
But she's still going strong.
I feel how she does this work as much. I feel like that is the most fully embodiment of Jesus, you know, on this earth. Because he's defending people that everyone else in the world hates, you know, sex offenders, I mean, people who would be seen completely irredeemable, or just, you know, terrible things they've done.
Yeah.
And yet he's the one person who's caring for them, truly caring for them. It is his job, but I think he also, I mean, he grew up in a conservative Christian home, you know, and he's not, we're not conservative Christian anymore, but nonetheless, I think, yeah, he just feels that same sense of you need to truly care for your person. It's a way about the unlovable, you know, which is, I guess, what Christianity is about.
Yeah, to say nobody's as bad as the worst things they've ever done. You know?
Oh, yeah, that, right.
And if we're defined by this one moment of our lives, then.
Yes, that's what the Bible would say, too.
Yeah.
I like Brian Stevenson's formula too, though, where he talks about how, you know, you have to, how he believes, you know, in truth and reconciliation, but they are sequential.
Yeah.
You can't have the reconciliation until you have the truth first. Yeah. So, like, that's why the South Africa thing worked.
Yeah.
Because they had all those talks about, you know, well, here's. Okay, we did all these terrible things, and we'll own up to it.
Right.
And I need to do
that. Otherwise, it's like, forgive you for what? Right.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, yeah, I mean, he's so good and eloquent at getting all that stuff across.
Yeah.
You know? I'd encourage you to go down to that.
Yeah, Joe.
If you get any chance.
Road trip, Joe.
Where to?
Montgomery.
To Brian Stevenson's Museum for Lynching, you know?
Oh.
Well, there's two things. There's the Lynching Memorial.
The Memorial.
But there's also the museum that takes you through, you know, like the, you know, it's interesting. It's wonderful. That's the Lynching Memorial.
I'm good.
Are you talking about the
Trump Museum? Did you go there?
I have not. I've been urban here. It's on my bucket list.
Oh, it's fantastic. We're in the Portland area, and we went to it.
It's absolutely.
Okay, as folks come back in, I'm going to ask you to find a place you're comfortable, wherever that is. Yep. If you can't see the board, just let me know and we'll. So, how is it that we think? This is the question that cognitive scientists started paying attention to in a new, fairly new way in the 1980s. And as I said, it comes out of two major strands of learning. The linguists and the neuroscientists and AI people. The linguists had been doing what linguists do forever, which is going around and looking at languages. How is French constructed? How is German constructed? How is Kukui-Yimithurt constructed, which is a northwestern Australian language? And in the 70s and 80s, one of the things that happens in the postmodern era, which I think is really healthy, is we stopped trying to tell universal stories that explain everything, right? You've all heard of Joseph Campbell. Mm-hmm. Joseph Campbell wrote a very important and very wrong book about how all cultures have the one story, right? We get Star Wars out of it, great. But in fact, what you're doing is going around the world saying, hey, this is an important story in Western European and Western Asian cultures. Everyone must have this story in exactly this way, right? And then we start saying, okay, so if that's not true, then what are the things? Where are the differences? And so the linguists started looking for, are concepts that we assume to be the same everywhere actually the same everywhere? Color, time, location. Turns out some of them are and some of them are not. Some of them are different, but emerge in ways that are predictable. So, for example, let me start with location, because that's in some ways the most surprising to us. Most languages, almost all languages, are what we call egocentric. So, if I can say to you, hand me your glasses, or I can say, move 3 steps to your left. All of those things are based on my location and your location in the world. There are a few languages, like Kuku-Yimother, which, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, because I've only ever seen it written, but it's spelled with G's, which are geocentric languages, famously, in which, in order to say, hand me your glasses, you have to know what direction I am from you. And I say to you, move your glasses in the, wait a second, I can do this. Nope, I can't. Where's north? I'm lost. North is...
Oh, right now?
North is there, right? Yeah, north is there. So move your glasses in the east by southeasterly direction. I can't give you directions that say, turn out of Koinonia and turn left. I have to say, turn out of Koinonia and turn west. Right? It's a language that is based entirely on, does all of its location finding on a 64-point compass. And so everybody has to carry around in their head a 64-point compass and always know where north is. Now, it's not like the people who speak Kuku-Yimother have different brains than you do, right? If you start speaking this language, over time, you will develop the ability to hold on to north. I'm fairly good at directions, but when I was a kid, my dad would always ask us, which way is the lake? I grew up in Cleveland, the lake is north, so north is a way of talking about the lake. I then lived in Chicago for a while, and every time I would see the lake, I would get super confused because the lake is east, which is not where big lakes are supposed to be, right? And my whole map would shift, and I had to learn how to fight that. But if you were to become a speaker of Kuku-Yimother, you would develop this 64-point compass, and without thinking about it, you would say, could you move your glasses in the south by southeasterly direction, right? In fact, in order to say, how are you in this language, you say, what way are you facing? Right? So it's a very differently constructed language. Similarly, on time, we think about time as a human universal. There are languages, however, which conceive of the past as in front of you. Why? Because you can see the past.
Of course.
And the future is a mystery.
Huh.
We don't, our basic metaphors for time are based on walking, right? We think about time as a path we walk on.
It's linear. Linear.
It's linear, yeah. And, you know, our experience of time is pretty linear. But it hides this aspect of human experience that's immediately available to you as soon as I say, if the past is in front of you, it's what you can see. Right? If you think about time in terms of what you know, then that makes more sense. Color is a really interesting example. Because color, and this is where we're going to get into mediation, the thing that cognitive linguistics does most for me in theology is help me learn to be comfortable with mediation. Because, if you think about it, mediation, we'll talk a lot about this on Wednesday, is all through theology and religion, right? Jesus is the embodiment of God. The Eucharist is the body and blood of Christ. The church is the body of Christ. The scriptures are the word of God, right? Mediation. How do we know God? We know God in the scriptures, the Eucharist, the church, the poor, right? Those are mediations. But sometimes my students will say to me, well, yeah, but how do you know God? Mediation's hard. Let's think about color for a second. When you see, let's find a nice, simple color. When I say that the background of this cushion is green, what's going on? Does anyone disagree with me that the background of this cushion is green?
Yes.
What? Oh, sorry. Does anyone disagree with me that the background of this cushion is green?
We just have your color black.
Yeah, which is more likely because I'm a man, but yeah. So what's going on when we see that this is green? What's happening physically?
Comparing something against something we already know.
Okay, the artists tell us that the art is being absorbed and reflected by this cloth. Mm-hmm. What did I say?
The light.
The light is being absorbed and reflected back to your eye, right? So, at the very beginning, there's a couple of different things going on. The color of light in these light bulbs matters, right? You ever had a pair of whatever you bought at the store, you loved the color, you took them outside, and they were a totally different color. Yeah. Fluorescent lighting will do that to you, right? Because the light coming off of, that's bouncing off of this matters. Because you don't have any direct access to this cushion, right? What you have is perception of light. So on the first we have light. The light bounces off this. This thing interacts with the light. This one is fairly simple. It is a dye that absorbs and reflects colors of light. Most things that we engage with are that way, right? We have sort of simple color. There's also structural color in the world, though. Butterfly wings are not tinted the colors that we think they are. If you were to blow them up, they would not be those gorgeous colors. Butterfly wings have structures on them that interfere with how light bounces off of them. And so that blue on butterfly wings is actually a structure, not a pigment. You can't tell the difference, right? All you can see is the light that's coming into your eye. This is why when you hold up your cell phone, you see the green on the background of my and the blue and the black and all those things, right? There are lots and lots of tiny little pixels, right? That mix all of the colors. There are not a million different kinds of pixels in my phone that have different kinds of pigments. There's four, right? And those four lights set out wavelengths that interfere with each other in different ways to make your eye see color. So if I took a picture of this and held it up here, it would look the same to you. But in fact, the light coming to your eyes would be different, or at least different in how it got there, right? Then it gets to your eyes. Most of you, possibly all of you, have three kinds of cones plus rods in your eyes. Some of you, almost all of those people will be women, have a fourth kind of cone. And those act as logic switches in your eyes, right? So the wavelength comes in, it registers on or doesn't register on those particular receptors, and those receptors send to your brain, hey, in this spot there is this density of some kind of light in the range that I can receive, and that goes to your brain, right? So if you have four, you can imagine those people have a more differentiated spectrum of color that they see. Someone who's colorblind may have just two, or sometimes even just one of those cones, right? The reason that we have trouble seeing color at night is because the rods in our eyes are very sensitive to low levels of light, but can't register color. And so if you get below the place where your cones are in sort of intensity of light, you're not getting the signals that your brain can then interpret as color. So when the green hits my eye, one of the cones is lighting up really heavily, another one probably a little bit, and the third one probably not so much. Have you ever played around with color on your computer screen? It's got the RGB sliders, right? Or those three numbers to get a particular color. That's basically what's happening in your eyes when you see color. And then that information is going back to your brain, which is putting it all back together and interpreting it in a way that you get some data. It's another level of mediation, right? And then, finally, you exist in a culture and speak a language that has words for color in different ways. And these differ. There are cultures that have only two words for color, light and dark, are always the first two words. Then, if we get a third word, it's always red. Yellow, green, and blue come in some order after that. I used to be able to do all 17 of these. I can't off the top of my head anymore. But you see what I'm saying. And it's because of the underlying structure of how human eyes are built. Yeah.
My Maasai friends have like 20 words for brown.
Uh-huh.
Because they tell the health of the cattle, and there's all these little nuances that are just totally invisible to, like, at least for me. Okay.
Right.
And then, have you all heard of the mantis shrimp?
Mm-hmm.
The mantis shrimp, where they have more rods in their eyes. It's a creature in the ocean has rods in their eyes, and they can see more colors than the human eyes can see, like a multitude of colors that we don't even know are possible because of the way their eyes are.
Right. So let's go back over those kinds. So when Homer talks about the wine dark sea, which I think about every time I come up Lake Chelan, because when it's real dark, it's that color, right? But it's not wine-colored. It's not purple. Homer's talking about the wine dark sea, we think, because in the earliest piece of those epics, Greek may not have developed a word for purple, for blue yet, because it's one of those later developments. And this is a really old piece of text, right? So you can look back at ancient texts and see, and in some sense help date them by what kind of colors we're talking about. So let's...
Maybe it was a Chardonnay.
So let's go back over... I hope my Chardonnay is not blue. Let's go back over the levels of mediation we just talked about. We have the kind of light from our light source. We have the thing that's reflecting or refracting or interfering with light on some level. We have the structure of our eyes, which is taking in the light that comes to us. We have the way that that is taken and processed by our brains, right? Anytime you see an optical illusion, it's because something's happening in that engagement, right? How your brain, you know, you don't actually see the whole, it's not, your brain is not like a television, right? You don't have all of this at all the same time. About here, you have the most dense rods and cones in your eyes, right? So if you want to look at the clock, you can't read it. You can't get intelligible information off the clock out of the corner of your eye. You have to look at it. But you get the illusion of having the whole picture all the time because your brain is constantly updating as you look around, and we tend to look around a lot. Right? This is why in the military people are told to keep their head on a swivel, right? To keep make sure that the picture they have is up to date. Or it's also why you can be driving down the street and not see a pedestrian, right? Because they were in a part of your vision that hadn't been updated. That's a real experience, right? You've all had that before? You turn your head and you think, oh my gosh, how was that person there? I almost hit them. I had no idea they were there. So all of those levels of mediation are going on all the time. In the 90s, so Lakoff and Johnson in the 80s start this work, and they talk about, they think everything is in terms of metaphors from simpler to more complex things. They have a fairly simple structure where we interpret complex things in terms of less complex things. And they notice that languages nest these things, so you end up with metaphors. That, and as we said, a metaphor is a cross-domain mapping where I'm thinking about one thing in terms of another thing. My brain is a computer. Affection is warmth. Affection is warmth is interesting. Where does that come from? When I say, she's a warm person, he's a cold-hearted bastard. Where does, you all know what I mean.
Yeah.
Where does that basic metaphor come from?
Fine.
What?
Molecules,
the speed
of molecules.
Think about our human needs. Like, I think of Maslow's hierarchy of human needs, whatever. Like, when we feel warmth,
yeah,
it's like something that we need that we attribute to, like,
what are,
our needs being met.
What are our first experiences?
Yeah.
Our first experiences are being held. We are mammals.
Yeah.
Right? So a lot of our metaphors, a lot of our basic metaphoric structures go to the fact that we are upright bipedal mammals that have the kinds of bodies that we do. Equality is balance. When you're learning how to walk, balance is a thing you have to figure out, right? If you, more is up, more is better, up is better. If you were an ant, safety would be down. You are not an ant, right? These things become structures. So Lakoff and Johnson say, these are the metaphors. We build more complicated ideas out of less complicated ideas. And they see this as a universal in human languages, that this kind of nesting of ideas, this metaphoric mapping happens. Then in the 90s, this gets usefully complicated by a pair of guys named Gilles Flopinier and Mark Turner. And they say, okay, great, but actually it's not just more complex things thought of in less terms of less complex things. They say there's four basic ways that we do metaphoric mappings. The first is simplex. A simplex mapping is very much like running a mail merge. Has anyone ever had to do the awful thing of running a mail merge? So you have one file of data, and you have one file of labels, and you tell the computer, combine these things and give me address labels, or Christmas cards, or fundraising letters, or whatever, right? We've all done this?
Yeah.
So when I say to you, Soren is my godson. Soren's the cute little kid running around with me this week. Soren is my godson. That is a simplex metaphoric mapping. Because you know what a godson is, you know what that relationship is, and you take Soren and me and you plug them into that. Pretty simple, right? Mirror are blendings that happen when, they're not actually metaphorical, they're blendings though. They're blendings that happen when you take a number of different things that exist in the same cognitive realm and you hold them together in order to think about them. World records are a great example of mirror blends. If you think about all the people who've run the 100 meter dash over and held the record over the last 100 years, and you say Usain Bolt, I don't know if he still does, holds the men's world record for the 100 meter dash. In some sense, what you're doing is imagining him running a race against all of the other people who've ever run a 100 meter dash. And you're collapsing the differences of time and space and whatever, right? They all did the same thing. He was the fastest at that thing. But he didn't actually run a race against the people who held the record in 1912. Hmm. Right? You see how that's collapsing an important piece in order to understand how these things relate to each other? Then we start getting into the truly metaphoric things. And they, we have a simplex, I'm sorry, a, we did simplex. They are a single scope. Which is mostly what our friends Lakoff and Johnson were talking about. Single scope blends are what historically we think about when we talk about analogies. So if I say Achilles is a lion, what do I mean by that?
He's fierce and brave and a little bit scary.
Yeah, no, exactly. So what we're doing is we are taking one frame of reference, lions, and I am learning things about this other frame of reference in terms of that.
How is that different from a simplex?
A simplex is within, it's not metaphoric. It's not across one from one realm into another.
Not, I can learn something about this category by understanding something about the other category.
Yeah. So these would be more like what we historically would call literal. When I say Soren is my godson, right, there's not pieces of godsonness that you have to suppress in order to get truth there. On the other hand, when I talk about, when I say that Achilles is a lion, I don't mean that he's a cat. I don't mean that he has a mane, necessarily. Right? So you have to sort of, when we do these cross-domain mappings, we, without thinking about it, pick and choose which of the things apply. The important thing about single-scope blends is that they're unidirectional. When I say Achilles is a lion, I do not mean that lions are Greek. It doesn't work coming back the other way, right? Think about the difference between this butcher is a surgeon and this surgeon is a butcher. Right? Single scope blends, directionality matters a lot. The thing that Flopinier and Turner add is the double scope blend. The double scope blend is one of the most important pieces of human thinking. And much of our some of our most important things are in this category, and we don't even notice that we're doing it. In a double scope blend, two things are held together in such a way that they become mutually interpretive and both are changed by the equation.
Say that again, can you? Please?
Sure. In a double scope blend, two things in different domains are held together in tension, such that both of them are reinterpreted. And we, in a double scope blend, there are new things that we can say that were not possible before. Let me give you an example. I'll give you two, one not religious and one religious. There's an image, let me see if I can pull it up real quick. If I say to you, Soren was so angry, he really didn't want to go to Narnia this morning. If Soren was so angry that I thought his head would explode, I'm drawing pieces from both sides and making judgments based on, from both of them. Let me show you an image of this. On blends. I think I know my own book better than this. There we go. So, can y'all see this? This is what we, when we talk about, if I say this to you, we have here, what I thought his head would explode. I'm thinking about anger as heat, right? Why do things explode? Because they're under pressure, they're closed, and they get heat, right? So think about a tea kettle that you stop up. Eventually, if you keep adding heat to it, what's it gonna do? It's gonna explode. On the other hand, an angry person, we think about anger as heat. Why? Because when we're angry, our core temperature actually goes up, right? We experience ourselves, our face flushes, the blood comes to the surface of our skin, we get hot, right? When I hold these together, I end up with a whole new realm of things that I can sort of make inferences from that can apply all over the place in both of them, right? It's not like the lion, and it's not like Achilles is a lion. In this case, I'm drawing inferences from both directions. Let me give you a more interesting one. When we say Jesus is Messiah, that is a double scope blend. How do I know? I know because all of Jesus' disciples are confused. The story of, we have a pre-existing blend, the Jewish Messiah, right? We've got this guy, Jesus of Nazareth. Early Christians, starting from Emmaus, if we were going with the story, right? Early Christians don't see how these two things can possibly go together. What do they say on the way to Emmaus? To Jesus, as it turns out. They say, we had hoped that this was the Messiah. But he's dead, so I guess that can't be the case. This doesn't fit the story. Rome is still occupying our lands. There's no eschatological kingdom where lions and lambs are lying down. Everything is still here. And so what happens in the Emmaus story? Jesus explains to them as they're walking. And going through the scriptures to them, he explained to them why it was necessary that the Messiah should die in this manner. And they still don't get it. But when he breaks the bread for them, their eyes are opened. This is often how double scope blends work. Double scope blends do not necessarily give you new information. You hold together the information in such a way that you have new things you can actually say. This is not, let me give you an example that I think helps clarify this, because it's so everyday, even though it's not quite a double scope blend. I used to live in Milwaukee. I did my doctorate at Marquette. And I was going to visit some friends and decided to come back a different route from their house. I turned right instead of left, and as I went right, suddenly there in front of me was Target. I thought Target was about 2 miles away from me. My mental map of Milwaukee did not have these two pieces coming together, right? But by seeing Target there, I was forced to have my mental map shift. I mean, I suppose I could have said, no, Target's not actually there, but that would be really stupid, right? My mental map had to shift, and all the pieces had to rearrange themselves in light of this new piece of information. But I didn't really get new information from it. If I'd sat down with a piece of paper, I probably could have figured out that Target was there. But by holding those things together, the possibility of what I could do and say and go changes. Yeah?
I think about the parables here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, parabole, throw two things down side by side.
Yeah.
And hold them in attention until our map of reality has to shift in some significant way as long as we hold those two.
Exactly. The parables are...
I'm asking, would that be an example?
The parables are all are mostly examples of double scope lens. Wow. The kingdom of heaven is like, Jesus likes to say, right? And specifically the ones that are more complicated for us are often double scope lens. So what happens when we say that Jesus is the Messiah? Well, it changes both what we say about who Jesus is and how we understand everything that happens in his life, right? Remember, none of the early Christians, there are very few early Christians for whom the heresy is Jesus is God, but not human. That's a very contemporary, very common contemporary Christian heresy, right? But for the early Christians, they're not. That's not their worry. They knew the guy, right? He ate, drank, went to the bathroom, learned stuff, was occasionally wrong, right? So Messiah changes how we think about that, such that we now have to worry about keeping Jesus human sometimes. But it also changes how we talk about what it means to be Messiah. So when we talk about the Messiah, we're talking about a different thing because the story of Jesus couldn't have fit in the previous understanding. So if you think about everything that has come out of Christian thinking about who Jesus is and what the future of the world is like and what it means to have a Messiah in the first place, all of that is not possible without the double scope blend, Jesus is Messiah. And one of the things that we sometimes risk with double scope blends is that double scope blends can lose their tension. That doesn't mean we lose the data. It just means that we don't notice that they're double scope blends. So if we go back to the parables, right? How many times have you heard somebody stand up to preach and say, you've heard this parable 100,000 times. You're going to assume that this is obvious. We have to try and approach it as if it's not. That's because it's not that we learn new information, but remember, actually, let me go back to Jesus and Messiah for a second. I remember being in a Bible study in my parish as I was a kid, and there was an older woman there who said, in the middle, it was, we were reading Isaiah, it was Advent, you know, and she said, how can Jewish people read this and not think that Jesus is Messiah? It's just so clear. And that was entirely true for her, right? Because Jesus as Messiah had become such a foundational metaphor, appropriately, in her world, that she wasn't able to imagine a world in which that wasn't the metaphor by which you think. Because these metaphors are the very bones of our thinking. They're the structures in which we think. So, yeah?
Is it like changing perspective? Like you've got this two things standing side to side. You're looking at it in an egocentric
way. Yeah, sure.
Looking at these two things this way, but then all of a sudden you're shifting. Is it like a double scope forces you to simply change your perspective and now you're looking at the same thing from a different vantage point? Would that be the
problem? Kind of. So, but I want you to notice that's a metaphor.
Yeah.
You're thinking metaphorically about your thinking. Why are you thinking metaphorically about your thinking? Because there's no other way to do it.
I was going to say, what else? What I've been doing.
So,
that's my framework.
No, exactly.
If it is a time space, I'm thinking about it in a space continuum. Maybe could you do the same thing in a time continuum?
You probably could. And you would probably get different things out of making that thing about thinking about it. But what I want to point out most is we can't get to, this is a thing we can't actually get to a literal way of thinking about. Literal is not more basic in this sense. Metaphoric is the only way you can think about this thing. So when Bob Masson titles his book, Without Metaphor, No Saving God, he's not overstating the case. If we are not thinking metaphorically, we are incapable of thinking about God. We're going to talk about why that's even more true of God than other things on Wednesday. But this is true of so many things, right? If we're talking of, so the woman in this Bible study was speaking entirely truthfully within a system, within a way of thinking that she had been part of for so long that she couldn't think any other way. Sometimes, and on Friday we're going to talk about dialogue across difference, one of the things we come up against is we are disagreeing with people, not about what is, but on how about how we talk about it. Now, this is not to say I hate the old sort of God is an elephant thing, because it's not a good metaphor. It's a terrible metaphor. You know what I'm talking about? Someone had the trunk and someone had the tail or whatever. No, it's more like the Lutherans and the Catholics at the beginning of whatever, of today. Lutherans were saying, concupiscence is sin, because it's not God's desire for us. It's part of the fallenness of creation. And Catholics were saying, concupiscence is not sin, because if it were sin, then God's promise would be ineffective. Right? And so for 450 years, we said to each other, you are anathema because if you are right, we are not saved. In both directions. And in the course of 50 years of dialogue about justification in the 20th century, we came to a point where we could say, if you construct the questions in this way, the answers you're going to get are concupiscence is not sin. But if you construct the questions in this way, the answers that you're going to get are concupiscence is sin. And what we're talking about is different metaphoric ways of thinking. Now let me step back and say, this is not just a sort of one way of boiling down this talk that is not my intention is the mind is like a parachute. It works best when open. That's not the point of this talk, right? It's not untrue, right? But there's no way to escape this. And so partly what I'm saying is all of us are thinking metaphorically all the time, and there's no way to get around it. And so when we come up against one of these places where we really disagree with each other, somebody might be wrong. Somebody might be sinful. But you can't really judge that until you understand what it is they're saying in the first place. And oftentimes we don't notice the place where we disagree with each other. Let me give you another example from contemporary world. I teach at a Catholic college. I have one group of students who are viscerally and deeply, and they can't imagine being anything else, pro-life. I have another group of students who are the same way about pro-choice, right? And oftentimes, they are incapable of talking to each other because the metaphor by which they're approaching the question is different, right? One of them ends up saying, this is a Holocaust, and the only reaction to it is to stop it by whatever means necessary. The other says, if we go back, we produce a different kind of Holocaust, and also patriarchy is real. And I'm not willing to change on how I engage with those things. But that prevents my students from having a conversation with each other about even the things they agree on in these things. Right? So my pro-choice students are not willing to talk about the ways in which perhaps abortion should be limited, because the slippery slope is always there, right? We shouldn't allow people to terminate pregnancies because of fetal defect or because of the sex of the child or whatever the thing is, right? And my pro-life students are oftentimes unable, to recognize the real concerns of these other students. And so they end up sometimes saying, well, the patriarchy is not really real. And so their vision of the world is distorted by this thing they're trying to protect. And this is the thing about all metaphoric thinking. Metaphoric thinking reveals and it conceals. I had a teacher in grad school, Kevin Seasoltz. I wish you all could have met him. He was a 6'4", 125-pound monk. Yeah. In this, the black robe is slimming anyway, so you can imagine what happens when you put someone who's a skeleton in it. And he talked like Julia Child. And he used to say, sacraments reveal and sacraments conceal. And this is true of every single metaphoric way of thinking. I love his voice because it helps people remember what you're talking about. And so one of the things we have to learn to do if we're going to think as embodied persons and pay attention to the ways in which affection is warmth, or as we're going to talk about on Wednesday, purity is whiteness, or Advent is the triumph of light over darkness, hook into other sets of metaphors that we have in ways that some of us are more likely to see than others. Mm-hmm. Some nodding in the back?
Yeah, I'm like, I've had those conversations.
There's a book in the library which I will recommend to you, which will be returned to the library shortly.
I'll get it back.
By Lenny Duncan. It's called Dear Church. And he's engaging with a lot of these questions. Now, he is willing to take a more provocative stance on some of these questions than I, as a systematic theologian, might. I don't think we can get rid of light and darkness in Advent, but I do think we need to think really deeply about how light and darkness gets into race, right? And how these two things, these two, because, if you haven't been here, I don't know if this is still happening or not, the year that I was here, we burned all the Christmas trees on Epiphany up on the tailings, which is an old Christian tradition. Because kind of like Sun Over Buckskin Day, Advent and Epiphany are playing with images of light and darkness to talk about how we live in the already not yet. Right? And I can't imagine what a church would be like without that metaphor. But I also can't deny, specifically as a white American, all of the ways in which white supremacy ties into those things historically and has used intentionally all of those metaphors as a way of dehumanizing people. Mm-hmm. Right? So, on Wednesday, we're going to come back. I hope you can all join us if you're in the village. And talk about what in the world embodiment has to do with religion when we're talking about things that may seem like they're either literal or totally disembodied, right? Hint, it's us, right? We are the ones doing the theology. We can only think in this way. But we're going to get into some of these questions about how ritual shapes us, about how metaphor shapes us, and what we can think and cannot think. Thank you so much for being attentive and with us today. I promise I'll talk a little bit less on Wednesday. So.
Thank you.